Good evening, everybody. Great to be with you on this Saturday night. We are in the book of Genesis tonight, chapter 30. If you brought a Bible, if you forgot one, raise your hand and our service team will get one to you. It's so fulfilling going through the book of Genesis because it's the book of beginnings. It's the book where we get the fundamental perspective of our worldview, especially in the first 11 chapters, but it's so relational, it just keeps rolling through marriage and children, marriage and children. And if you have marriage and children, you have tension. Newsflash, you never figured that out, right? Maybe you know some married people. And all the way through the scriptures, from the time that Adam and Eve fell, I think Adam and Eve were a couple that had tremendous tension, don't you think? Can you imagine what their arguments were like, right? How long did we have paradise and total perfection? Eve, yeah, until you messed it up and you ate for the tree. Well, you didn't have to follow up. It's all your, you can just see it going around and around. And every day he comes home from work. Now there's thorns and thistles and I'm sweating and stinking, and it's your fault. She's looking at him as she's bearing a child in tremendous pain. This is all your fault. It's amazing when wives get pregnant how much it is all your fault, right? Through the pain, through the suffering, all the stuff. What I love about the scriptures is that it is real, that it's reality, and it doesn't varnish, it doesn't gloss over, it doesn't somehow prop up unrealistic people for us to learn from. It shows us the tension behind the scenes. It shows us the struggles that they're going through. It shows us the emotional ups and downs. And sometimes you come into a room like this on a Saturday night and you think, you know what? I'm the only person in the room having struggles. I'm the only one here. You come in and you look at these people and they're worshiping Jesus and they sit down, they're smiling at each other and you sit down, I'm the only one. And there's 10 other people in the room thinking the exact thing. I'm the only one that has struggles. I'm the only one that has loneliness. I'm the only one that has this temptation. People have told me for 40 years, oh, Rick, you don't understand the temptations that I have. I said, I absolutely do. And they're like, no, you don't understand. Hey, there's no temptation except that which is common to man. That just because that particular temptation doesn't pull on me in the same way it pulls on you, doesn't mean I haven't sensed it or felt it or experienced it. And that's why we come tonight to a Savior that the scriptures declare He was tempted in all points. That literally means Jesus, there is nothing in the plethora and the boatload of the repertoire and the menu of sin that he did not get tempted with. He sensed it all. He felt it all pull on him, and yet he resisted. So for us, as we follow characters like this, as we look at our message tonight, struggles of life, and it's going to be surround two things, which is primarily where you spend all your time, and that is with your family, your wife, your kids, the husband, the in-laws, and your work. And between those two things, that consumes the majority of all of your time. Now, you'll come to church on a Sunday or a Saturday night, but the majority of your time is consumed with family relationships and your vocation or work. And the first half of this chapter is all about the family struggles, about the marriage struggles, and about that painful experience that we start off with, which is the issue of infertility. It tells us in verse 1 about Rachel. Now, when Rachel saw that she bore Jacob no children, Rachel envied her sister and said to Jacob, give me children or else I die. Do you think that's a very calm conversation over a cup of coffee? This is a very passionate, frustration filled and motivated by envy. She looks at her sister. They're both married in the same week to the same man. Leah has had, it says, when the Lord saw that Leah was unloved, he opened her womb and she conceived. And boom, 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 4 years in a row probably, she had a male son. And every time she had a son, she named that son a desire that she had to have her husband's affection. To have, now if I have my, give my husband children, he'll love me like he loves Rachel because Rachel was his favorite. So she envied her. Now, Rachel had the heart and affection of the husband. Leah had all the kids. And if you've ever been around people when they're really fruitful, they're flourishing, they have multiple children, and you're struggling with infertility, and you're struggling to be able to get pregnant, and you go home for Thanksgiving, and oh, you know your sister's gonna be there with her six children, and all I gotta do is hear about that. And then the grandparents, all grandparents wanna talk about is grandchildren, right? So it's almost like, now I mean, I sincerely have a deep, loving relationship with my kids, but when the grandkids are around, it just gets eclipsed by these little treasures, these little kids. And I'll come when I walk in the door, my grandkids call me Bopo, and they'll come running at me, Bopo! And I just get down on their level, and immediately I'm in their world. And my daughter walks up and says, Dad, I am your daughter. We'll start here. Right? Yes. It's like, you can't overlook me. But that envy was eating Rachel up, and then it began to cause marital tensions. Now, when there is an infertility problem, you don't know if it's the man or the woman, correct? But if you have two wives and the one wife has four kids, there's no question where the issue lies. It's squarely with Rachel. She is not able to have children at this season of life, and she demands, can you demand that, can Jacob solve this problem? It sounds like they're practicing a lot. He's doing his part. That's all he can do, right? That's all he can do. And Jacob's anger was aroused against Rachel, and he said, am I in the place of God who has withheld from you the fruit of the womb? I want you to know something, and maybe you're here tonight, somebody invited you, and you're in that season, and you've been wanting to get pregnant. You've been married 3 or 4 years, you're wanting to get pregnant, and it's just not happening in the way that you think. When my wife and I, when I came home and she wanted to she said, hey, I'm ready for kids. We'd been married 2.5 years or so. And then each month, right, you're just waiting for her to miss her monthly cycle so that you can celebrate that she's, like every month is gonna happen yet. And so that pressure, and then when the months turn into years, that's super hard. It's very difficult. And it's an emotional tension, and then when you have a sister that is a rival, not just the sister you see at Thanksgiving and Christmas, but actually is right next door to you, and you see all the kids, and how God is favoring her. And Jacob tells her, am I in the place of God? Honey, I can't help you conceive. That's something God has to do. All through the scriptures, God uses seasons of unfruitfulness and barrenness in the lives of men and women to get their attention and draw their hearts to him. You see it in Sarah's life. We see it in Rebecca's life. We see it in Rachel's life. We see it in Hannah's life. We see it in Elizabeth's life. All the way through the scripture. Why is that? Because through that process, God, one of the dearest things to a woman's heart, when they finally realize that I've got to trust God, not only with my life, but this area too, you go deeper in your walk with God when you begin to trust him with the most intimate, heartfelt issues of your soul. Well, Rachel, she's got a plan in verse 3. So she said, here is my maid Bilhah. Go into her, and she will bear a child on my knees, that I also may have children by her. Then she gave him Bilhah, her maid, as wife, and Jacob went in to her. And Bilhah conceived and bore Jacob a son. Then Rachel said, God has judged my case and has also heard my voice and given me a son. Therefore, she called his name Dan, which means judge. God has judged her case between the rivalry of her and her sister. And Rachel's maid, Bilhah, conceived again and bore Jacob a second son. Then Rachel said, with great wrestlings, I have wrestled with my sister, and indeed, I have prevailed. So she called his name Naphtali, which means wrestler. In their culture, if you can't have a child and you're going through to the fertility clinic, then we have the high technology now. But in old school, if you wanted to have a surrogate, right, you just had somebody. There's no way to, in a laboratory, inseminate an egg. So it was an actual sexual intimacy. So she gives her handmaid so that she can be in competition with her sister, and she adds another girl to the mix. Exactly what you need, ladies, right? Right? Let's have three ladies in this process. And I come from a neck of the woods in Idaho where they have polygamous colonies because of strong Mormonism. And so you'll go into Brougham's is the Mormon grocery store in this one small community. And if you go there, depending on when you go, if you see two or three ladies with grocery carts there, they're sister wives. They've showed up in the van. One of the wives are, you know, at home with the kids, and they're still doing this same thing. Now, obviously, because of the law against bigamy, they're secret kind of covert things. But I can't imagine. Now it's mainstream because they had the reality show, right, Sister Wives, and I've never watched it. I've heard about it. And, I mean, the drama that must surround that. And yet, the only five-minute clip I saw that the Sister Wives are all just, we're friends and we're this or that. It's like, yeah. Ladies, yeah, is that going well? Yeah, that's rolling, right? So, the tension between Rachel and Leah and the children. Now, it tells us in verse 9, when Leah saw that she had stopped bearing children, she had four children right back to back, she took Zilpah, her maid, and gave her to Jacob as a wife, and Leah's maid, Zilpah, bore Jacob a son. Then Leah said, a troop comes. Like, I'm going to have an army of kids now. So she named his name Gad, which means troop. And Leah's maid, Zilpah, bore Jacob a second son. Then Leah said, I am happy for the daughters will call me blessed. So she called his name happy. Asher means happy. So now Leah gets in the act. And so now you have four women. This is a full-blown baby contest, and it's not over. It's just ramping up. And so Leah has four children. I want you to keep score. You got to keep score. You got a piece of paper. Leah has four, Rachel's maid Bilhah has two, Zilpah, Leah's maid, has two. So we're at eight children. We're going for 12. We'll have 13 because one of them is going to be a daughter. Pray tell, this family only has sons so that they can have the 12 tribes of Israel. And now we see this old school fertility. This is what they did have, something called love apples. You know, they had love apples. This is fruit of fertility. They call it mandrake. Mandrake literally means love apple. And in verse 14, now Reuben went out. Now Reuben's a teenager. Maybe he's 12. Went out in the days of wheat harvest and found mandrakes in the field and brought them to his mother Leah. Then Rachel said to Leah, please give me some of your son's mandrakes. But she said to her, is it a small thing? This is just Monday morning at their place, just so that you know. This is the kind of conversations they have. Is it a small matter that you have taken away my husband? Would you take away my son's mandrakes also? And Rachel said, therefore, he will lie with you tonight for your son's mandrakes. So she hires Jacob. Jacob was supposed to be in her bed, Rachel's bed that night. And she goes, for the mandrakes, Leah, you can have him in your bed. You can't make this stuff up. And when people come in and sit down across from me and they say, we have marriage problems, I have these things in the back of my mind also. We'll see. We'll really see if you have marriage problems, because this is a fantastic, crazy story. Verse 16, when Jacob came out of the field in the evening, Leah went out to meet him and said, you must come in to me, for I have surely hired you with my son's mandrakes. And he lay with her that night. And God listened to Leah, and she conceived and bore Jacob a fifth son. Leah said, God has given me my wages because I have given my maid to my husband. So she called his name Issachar, which means wages or salary. Then Leah conceived again and bore Jacob a sixth son. And Leah said, God has endowed me with a good endowment. Now my husband will dwell with me because I have borne him six sons. And so she named his name Zebulun, which means exalted. Now, God will exalt this relationship so that my husband will actually want to dwell with me. She's tried this six times. In six efforts, every time, she's really looking for the love of her husband. She has a son. She has sons. That's great. She has six sons now. And yet there's a part of her soul that just so longs to feel like she has that greatest intimacy with her husband. And that part of Jacob's heart was really never accessible to her because he had given her his deep affection to Rachel. He slept with her. You know, they have a rotation. Monday night it's Rachel. Tuesday night it's Leah. Then there's Bilhah and there's Zilpah. And the only one complaining in this whole baby contest who is not complaining is Jacob. Right? Here's a guy like, well, okay, I'm going to go work all day. We'll see what happens tonight. This is a lot of fun. I apologize and move forward. Verse 17. Oh, excuse me. I already read this. But Leah now, she's had four sons, and now she has six sons. And then it tells us in verse 21, afterwards she bore a daughter and called her name Dinah. And Dinah means judge. And she names her daughter a name to basically, hopefully, you know, I don't know if it's judge, may God judge Rachel, may God judge this situation and somehow vindicate me. But Dinah's going to be a key figure in the coming chapters because she's the only sister among 12 brothers. Imagine that. One sister, 12 brothers, and her story is going to be epic when we get to Shechem. In verse 22, then God remembered Rachel, and God listened to her and opened her womb. Now, for the first time, Rachel's going to get pregnant. By this time, there's 10 children. There's only going to be two more children. Well, there's 13. There's 11 if you count Dinah, but we're only talking the sons for the 12 tribes of Israel. So, for the first time, Rachel's going to have a child, which will be the 11th, and then she's going to have one more, Benjamin, which will be the 12th. And she conceived and bore a son and said, God has taken away my reproach. So she called his name Joseph and said, the Lord shall add to me another son. Joseph means add or added. She had a son and hoping and praying in a prophetic way that meant she's going to have another son. She's going to be able to add a son as well. She wanted this. Like everybody in ancient Israel and in ancient times, a large family was the blessing of the Lord. And we live in a culture that children are a burden. You know, maybe we'll squeak out one or two. And that's why the population rates around the world, in entire ethnic groups of people are going to be declined rapidly because you have a 2.3 birth rate to maintain your population. That's why China's mandate of only one child has caught up with them now. And the figures are quite catastrophic for them in China and actually around the world. The only cultures that are going to thrive are going to be those cultures that encourage children. All of Mexico, Central America, South America, that Catholicism really encourages no contraception and having lots of children, and also the Muslims. That's how they move into a community and just take over the whole place with lots of kids. Only the Western world are going to be declining rapidly. That's why by 2060, only 40 years, 36 years from now, the primary language in America will be Spanish, according to those who do studies. So if you want your children to be bilingual, I encourage you, that's the language they should learn. And, learn your Espanol, because that's what's coming. And in Hungary, a European country, because they see this and they want to maintain their Hungarian heritage, they actually, if parents will have a third child, they give them a big credit to buy a van or a larger car, and they're encouraging their birth rate in the country of Hungary. So as we look at this now, God listened to Leah in verse 17, and God remembered Rachel, and God listened to Rachel, and God opened her womb. Who was in charge of the conception rate, the birth rate, the productivity, the fruitfulness within these relationships? God's involved in all of that. Yes, there's the biological act of intimacy, but there's also the hand of God, and that we can invite God into the barren places of our life and ask him to help us. A lot of times it's not obviously having a physical child, but you might be here tonight and there's just some barren area of your life, or you've been consumed with the envy that you've got your eyes on somebody else and the blessings you see them have and you personally don't have. And there's nothing that robs you of your joy like envying somebody, is there? The green monster of envy. It's a brutal, sinful emotion that really makes you feel sick inside. And if you're breathing here tonight, you've been envious at times. Some people are a little happier for others than some, but everybody has experienced that situation where you look at somebody's life and you say, I wish I had their life. I wish I had what they had. And I actually hate their guts because they're just too blessed to enjoy life. We don't verbalize it that way because it would sound too awful, but you feel it inside. The wrestling match between these four women that's going on, but primarily between Rachel and Leah all the way through this, even in our brokenness with envy and struggle and selfishness and grief and tears and a husband and wife fighting and struggling, you know, give me children or I die. It is God's still involved in that process, right? He's still involved with you and me. Isn't that great? When you go through your wrestling matches and relationships and you don't act as you should, right? You don't behave in a way that you would want to be televised across the world. And yet God in his grace, he knows our frame, that we are dust. I want you to know that. And whatever your struggles are here tonight, whatever your issues are, whatever the distance or the obstacles in your relationship at this season, I want you to know that God knows your frame. He knows who you are. He knows who I am, and he will be with us in that process. So now we transition from the domestic front to basically the workflow of Jacob's life. Because you see, for 14 years, he has been working for Laban, his father-in-law. He worked 7 years for Leah, then he worked 7 years for Rachel, and that's all coming to an end. And in that 14 years, God has blessed Laban's socks off, and he knows, whoa, I had a little bit before this kid showed up, and when he showed up and took over, I've been so blessed. So now Jacob, though, he's tired of working. I mean, he's not tired of working. That was the agreement. He fulfilled his contract for 14 years for these two girls, and now he wants to do a renegotiation of his contract, so to speak. So now he has work struggles in verse 25, and it came to pass when Rachel had borne Joseph that Jacob said to Laban, send me away that I may go to my own place and to my country. Give me my wives and my children for whom I have served you, and let me go. For you know my service, which I have done for you. And Laban said to him, please stay if I have found favor in your eyes, for I have learned by experience that the Lord has blessed me for your sake. Then he said, name your wages and I will give it. He said, hey, I just want to leave. I don't want you to fight with me. I want to take, he's very vulnerable because of Laban's power and control and other servants. Give me my wives, give me my kids. I just want to take off and I'm going to go back to my country. And he's like, no, whatever you need, I'll pay, because I've discovered, check out this line again. Let me just ask all of us who go to work 8 to 5 or whatever it might be, Monday through Friday, you've been working your whole life. He says, I have learned by experience that the Lord has blessed me for your sake. Is there in your office, at your workplace, on your crew, what you do, is there a sense that those who would observe not only their company, observe that department, observe you, observe the either the quantity of work you perform or the quality of work, and hopefully both, that they go, wow, there's something special about this person. Even an ungodly supervisor, an ungodly owner can observe and just go, there's something about this person that when they're here, just everything's just blessed. It just works. And Joseph had this in his life. Joseph, when he goes to Potiphar's house, Potiphar just looked at everything he did, and he just said, wow, God's hand's on this kid, and if I just let him run everything, I'm blessed. Then he gets thrown in prison, and the warden puts him in charge, and the prison's blessed. How do you be a blessing in a prison? Well, Joseph had that ability to do that. In the real life, getting up from morning to night and just and showing up and being a fruitful employee is not complicated, is it? I show up on time, I work hard all day, I don't leave early, and I have a good attitude and a respectful attitude, and I do what I'm asked. And I'm gonna get a promotion in 3 months. And then I keep doing that, I'm gonna get a promotion. Throughout my entire life, all the way through construction, you show up on the job, there's only a handful of things, show up on time, a little bit early is better, work hard all day, have a good attitude, do what your boss requires you to do, and finish the job, and you're just going to get promoted everywhere you go. Jacob was really fruitful. He's got struggles in his marriage and family. He's got kids, and he's like, ay, ay, ay. Each morning he's like, can I go to work, please? You know, and out to the workplace he goes. And Laban is a real conniver. In the next couple of chapters, we're going to see everything that unfolds. And Laban really has no idea because he had a closed, firm contract. 7 years, you get nothing but my 2 daughters. That's it. And obviously, they're living from the food sources of what he's taking care of. In verse 29, it says, so Jacob said to him, you know how I have served you and how your livestock has been with me. For what you had before I came was little, and it has increased to a great amount. And the Lord has blessed you since my coming, and now when I shall I also provide for my own house? So he said, what shall I give you? And Jacob said, you shall not give me anything. What? If you will do this thing for me, I will again feed and keep your flocks. Now he's going to lay out the plan. This is a plan too good to be true for any individual that owns livestock for Laban. He can't believe it. Verse 32, let me pass through all your flock today, remove from there all the speckled and spotted sheep and all the brown ones among the lambs and the spotted and speckled among the goats, and these shall be my wages. So my righteousness will answer for me in time to come when the subject of my wages comes before you. Everyone that is not speckled and spotted among the goats and brown among the lambs will be considered stolen if it is with me. And Laban said, oh, that it were according to your word. Genetically, the majority of the sheep, the lambs, and the goats are all white in color according to this storyline. And so if you have the genetic mutation or the recessive gene, however you want to look at this, the recessive gene, when one's spotted or one's streaked or one's brown instead of white, that's an anomaly. And those are few. Let's call them, I don't know what the percentage is, maybe it's 5 to 10% of your actual flock. So 90 to 95% are the genetically dominant color. And so when he tells him this, he goes, I'm going to take all those spotted, streaked, and which are not very many, and brown ones and stuff, and I'm going to take all of them. And that'll be my wages. And I'll take care of your sheep. I'm going to still take care of your sheep. But we're going to separate now. And so in the future, how would you know whose sheep are whose, right? Well, All the solid color ones are going to be Laban's, and all the speckled, spotted, brown ones are going to be Jacob's. So very easy. So he goes through and he has however many he has. We don't know the number, but it's a small amount compared to the rest of the flock that Jacob has basically caused to flourish for the last 14 years. So verse 35 says, so he removed that day the male goats that were speckled and spotted, all the female goats that were speckled and spotted, every one that had some white in it, and all the brown ones among the lambs, and gave them into the hand of his sons. So Laban has sons, so he gives them to him. Then he put 3 days' journey between himself and Jacob fed the rest of Laban's flock. This is what Jacob does. And this is a mystery to Bible commentators, so check this out. In verse 37, now Jacob took for himself rods of green poplar and of almond and chestnut trees, peeled white strips in them, and exposed the white which was in the rods. And the rods which he had peeled, he set before the flocks in the gutters, in the watering troughs where the flocks came to drink, so that they should conceive when they came to drink. So the flocks conceived before the rods, and the flocks brought forth streaked, speckled, and spotted. Then Jacob separated the lambs and made the flocks face toward the streaked and all the brown in the flock of Laban, but he put his own flocks by themselves and did not put them with Laban's flock. People think, is this some kind of magic, some kind of folklore? What's he doing? He goes and he cuts these branches, and then he kind of peels off the bark and spots. So all the branches are spotted and streaked like he wants his sheep to be. And so here there's watering troughs. So imagine that when they have a well, so they pour out all the watering troughs. And when the sheep are going to come there, he puts these rods right in front of them. And when they see them, this is Jacob's act of faith. Now, in the coming chapter, Jacob says that he has a dream, that God gave him a dream about all of his shepherding type of stuff, the blessing of God on his life. And so maybe we're seeing here what he later shared with basically Rachel and Leah. He told them the story, and we didn't know it until we read the chapter next time we're together. But as if God gave him this thought or this plan, and he does it by faith. Because obviously those branches that are cut and various things, they're not gonna do anything genetically, right? Yet throughout the scriptures, and this is something important for you to kind of contemplate, oftentimes there is a point of contact for your faith to be released. When we call for the elders of the church, say you're sick. The Bible says, if you're sick, call for the elders of the church, or you come forward, and they will anoint you with oil, and the prayer of faith will bring recovery. Is there any healing power in some olive oil on your forehead? No. And so why do we do that? Because it's a point of contact. In your heart and your mind, you're like, hey, if I'm just obedient to God's word and what he says, when the elders anoint me with oil and pray for me, it's a place of the release of your faith. Think about the woman who has the issue for 12 years. She's hemorrhaging and constantly in her monthly menstrual cycle to where she was unclean. She couldn't be, she sat on the chair, it's unclean. She sat on the couch, it's unclean. She can't go to synagogue, everywhere. She can't go anywhere, she's unclean. And for 12 years, and then when she sees Jesus, she says, if I can do what? Touch the hem of his garment. Now, is there power in the hem of his garment? No, but that's the point. She thinks in her mind, by faith, when I touch him, power. And the scriptures, I mean, the people are jostling Jesus. I mean, it's like shoulder to shoulder. They're going through the crowd. He's almost getting trampled. And she touches the hem of his garment. And he doesn't see her because it's probably from behind. And he turns around and he says to Peter, he said, hey, who touched me? Pete's like, who hasn't touched you? You know, we're getting bumped and jostled as we're going down there. And he turns around and there she is. He said, because I felt virtue go out. I felt power. When she touched him, he felt power released. Power, he sensed, he did not see them, And yet, this is the, and in the Old Testament, we have this blue border with these tassels that God said for the children of Israel, which were basically a spiritual symbol for them to think of heaven. Blue is the color of heaven. And so they had this hem of his garment, and that's no doubt. It's like, hey, I can't have help here. I have no answers here horizontally. Where's my help? It's in heaven. Where's my help? God will help me. Where's my help? Who can intervene for me? And all through the scriptures, we have this point of faith or where God uses something physical as a representation to release faith. Paul the Apostle, it says, this is the only passage it talks about it in Acts chapter 19. He's a tent maker, so it's hot. He's got a sweatband. He's got an apron because he's a leather worker. He's doing tents. And people, because when Paul touched and people and prayed for them, they were healed. So people were stealing his sweatbands and his apron. And you know, every morning he's probably coming in, where's my stuff? And they were taking those and they were going and touching people with them by faith, because for them, the person that took it, that point of contact, God, it says, did unusual miracles. That's where you get this whole thing. You're going to have some TV evangelist, I prayed for this prayer cloth for you, and I'm going to send it to you. And that's it. What a great fundraising gimmick. We only see this passage once. God can do supernatural things, but he doesn't like being put in a box or a formula or to market his program so he can make a bunch of money. But these things took place. When Gideon was unsure whether to go into battle, he says, Lord, just be patient with me. I just want to make sure this is you. It's like, okay, put a fleece out. And in the morning, because the dew settles, the ground will all be wet. But I want the fleece to be first the ground dry, then the fleece wet. And the second day, he's like, oh God, please be patient with me again. And he puts the fleece out again. And this time, he wants it the opposite. Because the day before, the ground was dry and the fleece was so wet, he wrung out a bowl of water. That's how much was in it. And the next day, he wants it to be dry and the ground wet. Our faith oftentimes implements or reaches out in things that would make a place of contact. That's why we lay hands on people. Now, Jacob, in this old school sense, he's a shepherd. And whether God divinely gives him this plan that's contained within the dream that we see next time we're together in the upcoming chapter. And he says, I had this vision from God and these sheep and what was happening. So every time the sheep come, the solid colored sheep, they come, but they look at these stripped and speckled branches. Then they conceive and bear speckled sheep, which is his wages. He said, you don't have to give me anything. It's a rare thing to have speckled and spotted and brown and all that stuff. I'll just take these, you know, just this very rare things. No, now there's a flood of speckled. And what's going on? It's God's hand working with a guy's faith in this shepherd, supernatural type of way. And there's I think people can, you can take things too far with certain items to touch or this or that, that become icons. That's not happening here. But there is a need for us to have those places of the release of our faith in the unfolding of God's plan for our life. Well, now, in verse 41, and it came to pass whenever the stronger livestock conceived that Jacob placed the rods before the eyes of the livestock in the gutters and that they might conceive among the rods. But when the flocks were feeble, he did not put them in. So the feebler were Laban's and the stronger Jacob's. Thus the man became exceedingly prosperous and had large flocks, female and male servants, and camels and donkeys. So not only does he get the spotted, speckled, and brown, they're reproducing like crazy, but now when they come to the watering troughs, because when you come to the watering trough animals are in cycle, that's the place that they're congregated, so that's where conception and breeding happens a lot. And he would make the strong animals face the stronger animals, and that would give them strength. So the first part about the streaked spotted branches was about getting the right color of sheep for his wages. And then the next step is to have them be the strongest, healthiest, most vibrant sheep and cattle with the goats and various things. And through all of this, he becomes so prosperous. In 6 years, it says he had large flocks, female and male servants, camels and donkeys. So now it's been 20 years. 14 years he served for Laban. In the 6 years, God blesses him abundantly and prospers him abundantly through his plan here. Now, there's 3 days distance between the two of them. And we're going to see as we pick it up the next time that Laban's sons are now envious of him because their flocks are getting weaker and fewer, and Jacob is prospering like crazy. And the brothers are like, oh, our brother-in-law, he's stealing all dad's wealth. And he realized he falls out of favor, and now there's a time they got to split the sheets here. They got to separate. And that takes place in the next session when we're together. But all of this, think about it. We start with infertility of ladies and then a full-blown baby contest. Then we start with Jacob in his workplace, and those two things come together in our lives. Our families and our workload have been mingled together for all these years, right? And where do you find yourself? Are you 20 years in? Are you 40 years in? How far down the road are you in your walk with God and your growth with God, but also in your walk with your wife or your husband, your children, your grandchildren, your vocation? It's a crazy thing, isn't it, that in our workload, that oftentimes we pour out our lives for work. And for guys, we kind of go two different directions. And I just, as I wrap it up here, just this closing thought, is that from Genesis chapter 3, men and women kind of go two directions. Now, I know in a day and age that doesn't even understand gender and they can't figure out anything, that all of these things are either misogynist, chauvinistic, the patriarch, or whatever. You can look at it however you want to. This is reality. Look around the world. This is reality. And the reality is that when God sent, he brought judgment. He brought judgment to the serpent. We're not going to talk about that right now. And then he brought judgment to Eve. And he said, Eve, you're going to have, I'm going to multiply your birth and conception and the pain in that. And you're going to desire, your desire is going to be for your husband. It literally means it, your desire is to rule over your husband. But I'm going to give him the leadership role in this relationship. So that's built-in tension, right? That's why we call it the curse. That's the fall. Ladies want to run the show, yet God gave the husband a role of leadership to be able to move forward with things. So that's a wah, 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 right? That's lots of tension until you kind of figure out those things. And so that's her life. And if you look at it, ladies get together and pretty soon they're talking about the kids and they're talking about the grandkids and they got out the phone, look at this video. They're going through it like crazy. And guys get together and immediately say, what do you do for a living? So Adam's curse is you are going to go to the field. You're going to earn your bread by the sweat of your brow, and you're going to work your butt off just to be able to feed your family. That's what you're going to do. It's a dog-eat-dog thing out there. You just go out there and do it. And so you invest. The moms are investing in the kids so often, and the dad's investing in work. And that's why when you hit 20, 25 years, 30 years in a marriage, when you finally raise the kids and you've sent them off to college and you've done all those things, a lot of times because that separation is taking place, that they wake up one day and look at each other and go, who are you? Right? We've got the same address, but I don't think I know you anymore. And now you don't have the commonality. You're not taking the kids to soccer practice. You're not doing, you know what I mean? You have to, like when you get the empty nest, you who know, you have to, it's like a whole reorientation of of you and me, babe, we were happy before those Rugrats came along. And so that challenge that we see happening right here in this story, the unfolding of that for the family life of the ladies and then the vocational life of Jacob and Jacob's struggles that are going to be there are just the normal phases of life. When my daughter got married, she was 18 when she got married, and I tried to get her to slow down. Like, honey, why are you in a hurry to get married? And she goes, well, you and mom made it look so fun. I just had to try. So, okay. That's hard to argue with. But she gets married, and she's working at a hospital in Florida, and she's been working there about 6 months. And she's a transporter. And so they put people in wheelchairs or on gurneys, and they just go all over the hospital for 8 hours a day. And she'd walk about 7 to 8 miles a day, just transporting people all over the place. And after about 6 months, you know, she's 18, maybe she turns 19. She calls me and she says, Dad, do you know that people live their lives to eat, sleep, and go to work and then do it all over again? And I said, yes, honey, I'm very aware of that. That's what I've been doing for the last 30 years, right? But it's almost like this awakening. Like, you mean just... Because when you're a kid growing up, you get summer vacation, you get all these different things. And then the tensions that are within the relationship and the tensions that are within work. I don't know about you, but I just need a lot of God's grace over all these years. I need God's grace in my marriage, my walk with Him, with God, and in the workplace. Because I really want to be fruitful. But in the end, if I don't maintain the relationships in my life that matter, then it's going to be lonely at the end. It's going to be lonely at the end. Because no matter how much you pour out your heart into your work, you work there 50 years, they give you a nice little pen and say, thank you, and you go away. Your wife and your kids and your grandkids, great, they're going to be around that deathbed saying goodbye. So don't give up good things for the best things. Let's pray. Lord, we pray that your Spirit will just strengthen us here tonight by your Spirit. And I know that there are those who are here right now that are, they're struggling, Lord, in various ways, shapes, varieties. And in your grace, that word as we end here tonight is, and the Lord remembered Rachel, and the Lord remembered Leah. And Lord, whatever their name is, as they're sitting here tonight, Lord, you remember them. And I pray that your grace in a very special way, as they utter the prayer of their heart tonight, as they're closing and in this last worship song, and they're crying out to you, Lord, would you remember them? Would you see them? Would you answer them? Would you bring that fruitfulness into the barrenness and the barren places of their life, Lord? In Jesus' name, amen.